Chapter 8. Tarzan and the Great Apes. 3 days the ape man spent in resting and recuperating, eating fruits and nuts and the smaller animals that were most easily bagged, and upon the fourth he set out to explore the valley and search for the great apes. Time was a negligible factor in the equation of life. It was all the same to Tarzan if he reached the west coast in a month, or a year or 3 years. All time was his and all Africa. His was absolute freedom. The last tie that had bound him to civilization and custom had been severed. He was alone, but he was not exactly lonely. The greater part of his life had been spent thus, and though there was no other of his kind, he was at all times surrounded by the jungle peoples for whom familiarity had bred no contempt within his breast. The least of them interested him, and too, there were those with whom he always made friends easily, and there were his hereditary enemies whose presence gave a spice to life that might otherwise have become humdrum and monotonous. And so it was that on the fourth day he set out to explore the valley and search for his fellow apes. He had proceeded southward for a short distance, when his nostrils were assailed by the scent of man, of Gamangani, the black man. There were many of them, and mixed with their scent was another, that of Ashitarmangani. Swinging through the trees, Tarzan approached the authors of these disturbing scents. He came warily from the flank, but paying no attention to the wind, for he knew that man with his dull senses could apprehend him only through his eyes or ears, and then only when comparatively close. Had he been stalking Numa or Sheeta, he would have circled about until his quarry was upwind from him, thus taking practically all the advantage up to the very moment that he came within sight or hearing. But in the stalking of the dull clod man, he approached with almost contemptuous indifference, so that all the jungle about him knew that he was passing all but the men he stalked. From the dense foliage of a great tree he watched them pass a disreputable mob of blacks, some garbed in the uniform of German East African native troops, others wearing a single garment of the same uniform, while many had reverted to the simple dress of their forebears approximating nudity. There were many black women with them, laughing and talking as they kept pace with the men, all of whom were armed with German rifles, and equipped with German belts and ammunition. There were no white officers there, but it was nonetheless apparent to Tarzan that these men were from some German native command, and he guessed that they had slain their officers and taken to the jungle with their women, or had stolen some from native villages through which they must have passed. It was evident that they were putting as much ground between themselves and the coast as possible, and doubtless were seeking some impenetrable fastness of the vast interior, where they might inaugurate a reign of terror among the primitively armed inhabitants, and by raiding, looting, and rape grow rich in goods and women at the expense of the district upon which they settled themselves. Between two of the black women marched a slender white girl. She was hatless, and with torn and disheveled clothing that had evidently once been a trim riding habit. Her coat was gone and her waist half torn from her body. Occasionally and without apparent provocation, one or the other of the negresses struck or pushed her roughly. Tarzan watched through half-closed eyes. His first impulse was to leap among them and bear the girl from their cruel clutches. He had recognized her immediately, and it was because of this fact that he hesitated. What was it to Tarzan of the apes what fate befell this enemy spy? He had been unable to kill her himself, because of an inherent weakness that would not permit him to lay hands upon a woman, all of which of course had no bearing upon what others might do to her. That her fate would now be infinitely more horrible than the quick and painless death that the ape man would have meted to her only interested Tarzan to the extent that the more frightful the end of a German, the more in keeping it would be with what they all deserved. And so he let the blacks pass with Fräulein Bertha Kircher in their midst, or at least until the last straggling warrior suggested to his mind the pleasures of black baiting and amusement, and a sport in which he had grown ever more proficient since that long gone day when Kulanga, the son of Manga, the chief, had cast his unfortunate spear at Kala, the ape man's foster mother. The last man, who must have stopped for some purpose, was fully a quarter of a mile in rear of the party. He was hurrying to catch up when Tarzan saw him, and as he passed beneath the tree in which the ape man perched above the trail, a silent noose dropped deftly about his neck. The main body still was in plain sight, and as the frightened man voiced a piercing shriek of terror, they looked back to see his body rise, as though by magic, straight into the air, and disappear amidst the leafy foliage above. For a moment the blacks stood paralyzed by astonishment and fear. But presently the burly sergeant, Isanga, who led them, started back along the trail at a run, calling to the others to follow him. Loading their guns as they came, the blacks ran to succor their fellow, and at Isanga's command they spread into a thin line that presently entirely surrounded the tree into which their comrade had vanished. Isanga called but received no reply. Then he advanced slowly with rifle at the ready, peering up into the tree. He could see no one, nothing. The circle closed in until 50 blacks were searching among the branches with their keen eyes. What had become of their fellow? They had seen him rise into the tree and, since then, many eyes had been fastened upon the spot, yet there was no sign of him. One, more venturesome than his fellows, volunteered to climb into the tree and investigate. He was gone but a minute or two, and when he dropped to earth again he swore that there was no sign of a creature there. Perplexed, and by this time a bit awed, the blacks drew slowly away from the spot, and with many backward glances and less laughing continued upon their journey until, when about a mile beyond the spot at which their fellow had disappeared, those in the lead saw him peering from behind a tree at one side of the trail just in front of them. With shouts to their companions that he had been found, they ran forwards. But those who were first to reach the tree stopped suddenly and shrank back, their eyes rolling fearfully first in one direction, and then in another, as though they expected some nameless horror to leap out upon them. Nor was their terror without foundation. Impaled upon the end of a broken branch, the head of their companion was propped behind the tree, so that it appeared to be looking out at them from the opposite side of the bole. It was then that many wished to turn back, arguing that they had offended some demon of the wood upon whose preserve they had trespassed. But Isanga refused to listen to them, assuring them that inevitable torture and death awaited them should they return and fall again into the hands of their cruel German masters. At last his reasoning prevailed to the end that a much subdued and terrified band moved in a compact mass, like a drove of sheep, forward through the valley, and there were no stragglers. It is a happy characteristic of the Negro race, which they hold in common with little children, that their spirits seldom remain depressed for a considerable length of time after the immediate cause of depression is removed, and so it was that in half an hour Isanga's band was again beginning to take on to some extent its former appearance of carefree lightheartedness. Thus were the heavy clouds of fear slowly dissipating, when a turn in the trail brought them suddenly upon the headless body of their erstwhile companion lying directly in their path, and they were again plunged into the depth of fear and gloomy forebodings. So utterly inexplicable and uncanny had the entire occurrence been that there was not a one of them who could find a ray of comfort penetrating the dead blackness of its ominous portent. What had happened to one of their number each conceived as being a wholly possible fate for himself, in fact quite as probable fate. If such a thing could happen in broad daylight, what frightful thing might not fall to their lot when night had enshrouded them in her mantle of darkness? They trembled in anticipation. The white girl in their midst was no less mystified than they, but far less moved, since sudden death was the most merciful fate to which she might now look forward. So far as he had been subjected to nothing worse than the petty cruelties of the women, while, on the other hand, it had alone been the presence of the women that had saved her from worse treatment at the hands of some of the men, notably the brutal black sergeant, Isanga. His own woman was of the party a veritable giantess, a virago of the first magnitude, and she was evidently the only thing in the world of which Isanga stood in awe. Even though she was particularly cruel to the young woman, the latter believed that she was her sole protection from the degraded black tyrant. Late in the afternoon the band came upon a small palisaded village of thatched huts set in a clearing in the jungle close beside a placid river. At their approach, the villagers came pouring out, and Nisanga advanced with two of his warriors to palaver with the chief. The experiences of the day had so shaken the nerves of the black sergeant that he was ready to treat with these people rather than take their village by force of arms, as would ordinarily have been his preference. But now a vague conviction influenced him that there watched over this part of the jungle a powerful demon who wielded miraculous power for evil against those who offended him. First, Isanga would learn how these villagers stood with this savage god, and if they had his good will, Isanga would be most careful to treat them with kindness and respect. At the palaver, it developed that the village chief had food, goats, and fowl which he would be glad to dispose of for a proper consideration. But as the consideration would have meant parting with precious rifles and ammunition, or the very clothing from their backs, Isanga began to see that after all it might be forced upon him to wage war to obtain food. A happy solution was arrived at by a suggestion of one of his men, that the soldiers go forth the following day and hunt for the villagers, bringing them in so much fresh meat in return for their hospitality. This the chief agreed to, stipulating the kind and quantity of game to be paid in return for flour, goats, and fowl, and a certain number of huts that were to be turned over to the visitors. The details having been settled after an hour or more of that bickering argument, of which the native African is so fond, the newcomers entered the village, where they were assigned to huts. Bertha Kircher found herself alone in a small hut to the palisade at the far end of the village street, and though she was neither bound nor guarded, she was assured by Isanga that she could not escape the village without running into almost certain death in the jungle, which the villagers assured them was infested by lions of great size and ferocity. Be good to Isanga, he concluded, and no harm will befall you. I will come again to see you after the others are asleep. Let us be friends. As the brute left her, the girl's frame was racked by a convulsive shudder as she sank to the floor of the hut and covered her face with her hands. She realized now why the women had not been left to guard her. It was the work of the cunning Isanga, but would not his woman suspect something of his intentions? She was no fool, and, further, being imbued with insane jealousy, she was ever looking for some overt act upon the part of her ebon lord. Bertha Kircher felt that only she might save her, and that she would save her, if word could be but gotten to her. But how? Left alone and away from the eyes of her captors for the first time since the previous night, the girl immediately took advantage of the opportunity to assure herself that the papers she had taken from the body of Hauptmann Fritz Schneider were still safely sewn inside one of her undergarments. Alas! Of what value could they now ever be to her beloved country? But habit and loyalty were so strong within her that she still clung to the determined hope of eventually delivering the little packet to her chief. The natives seemed to have forgotten her existence. No one came near the hut, not even to bring her food. She could hear them at the other end of the village laughing and yelling, and knew that they were celebrating with food and native beer, knowledge which only increased her apprehension. To be prisoner in a native village in the very heart of an unexplored region of Central Africa, the only white woman among a band of drunken Negroes. The very thought appalled her. Yet there was a slight promise in the fact that she had so far been unmolested, the promise that they might, indeed, have forgotten her, and that soon they might become so hopelessly drunk as to be harmless. Darkness had fallen and still no one came. The girl wondered if she dared venture forth in search of Naradu, Isanga's woman, for Isanga might not forget that he had promised to return. No one was near as she stepped out of the hut and made her way toward the part of the village where the revelers were making merry about a fire. As she approached, she saw the villagers and their guests squatting in a large circle about the blaze before which a half dozen naked warriors leaped and bent and stamped in some grotesque dance. Pots of food and gourds of drink were being passed about among the audience. Dirty hands were plunged into the food pots, and the captured portions devoured so greedily that one might have thought the entire community had been upon the point of starvation. The gourds they held to their lips until the beer ran down their chins, and the vessels were wrested from them by greedy neighbors. The drink had now begun to take noticeable effect upon most of them, with the result that they were beginning to give themselves up to utter and licentious abandon. As the girl came near, keeping in the shadow of the huts, looking for Naradu, she was suddenly discovered by one upon the edge of the crowd, a huge woman, who rose, shrieking, and came toward her. From her aspect, the white girl thought that the woman meant literally to tear her to pieces. So utterly wanton and uncalled for was the attack that it found the girl entirely unprepared, and what would have happened had not a warrior interfered may only be guessed. And then Isanga, noting the interruption, came lurching forward to question her. "What do you want?" he cried. "Food and drink. Come with me." And he threw an arm about her and dragged her toward the circle. "No," she cried, "I want Naradu. Where is Naradu?" This seemed to sober the black for a moment, as though he had temporarily forgotten his better half. He cast quick, fearful glances about, and then, evidently assured that Naradu had noticed nothing, he ordered the warrior who was still holding the infuriated black woman from the white girl to take the latter back to her hut, and to remain there on guard over her. First appropriating a gourd of beer for himself, the warrior motioned the girl to precede him, and thus guarded she returned to her hut, the fellow squatting down just outside the doorway, where he confined his attentions for some time to the gourd. Bertha Kircher sat down at the far side of the hut awaiting she knew not what impending fate. She could not sleep, so filled was her mind with wild schemes of escape, though each new one must always be discarded as impractical. Half an hour after the warrior had returned her to her prison, he rose and entered the hut, where he tried to engage in conversation with her. Groping across the interior, he leaned his short spear against the wall and sat down beside her, and as he talked, he edged closer and closer until at last he could reach out and touch her. Shrinking, she drew away. "Do not touch me," she cried. "I will tell Isanga, if you do not leave me alone, and you know what he will do to you." The man only laughed drunkenly, and, reaching out his hand, grabbed her arm, and dragged her toward him. She fought and cried aloud for Isanga, and at the same instant the entrance to the hut was darkened by the form of a man. "What is the matter?" shouted the newcomer in the deep tones that the girl recognized as belonging to the black sergeant. He had come, but would she be any better off? She knew that she would, not unless she could play upon Isanga's fear of his woman. When Isanga found what had happened, he kicked the warrior out of the hut and bade him beckon, and when the fellow had disappeared, muttering and grumbling, the sergeant approached the white girl. He was very drunk, so drunk that several times she succeeded in eluding him, and twice she pushed him so violently away that he stumbled and fell. Finally he became enraged and, rushing upon her, seized her in his long, ape-like arms. Striking at his face with clenched fists, she tried to protect herself and drive him away. She threatened him with the wrath of Naradu, and at that he changed his tactics and began to plead, and as he argued with her, promising her safety and eventual freedom, the warrior he had kicked out of the hut made his staggering way to the hut occupied by Naradu. Isanga, finding that pleas and promises were as unavailing as threats, at last lost both his patience and his head, seizing the girl roughly, and simultaneously there burst into the hut a raging demon of jealousy. Naradu had come. Kicking, scratching, striking, biting, she routed the terrified Isanga in short order, and so obsessed was she by her desire to inflict punishment upon her unfaithful lord and master, that she quite forgot the object of his infatuation. Bertha Kircher heard her screaming down the village street at Isanga's heels, and trembled at the thought of what lay in store for her at the hands of these two, for she knew that tomorrow at the latest Naradu would take out upon her the full measure of her jealous hatred after as he had spent her first wrath upon Isanga. The two had departed but a few minutes when the warrior guard returned. He looked into the hut and then entered. "Oh, one will stop me now, white woman," he growled as he stepped quickly across the hut toward her. Tarzan of the Apes, feasting well upon a juicy haunch from Bara, the deer, was vaguely conscious of a troubled mind. He should have been at peace with himself and all the world, Nor was he not in his native element, surrounded by game in plenty, and rapidly filling his belly with the flesh he loved best. But Tarzan of the Apes was haunted by the picture of a slight, young girl being shoved and struck by brutal negresses, and in imagination could see her now camped in this savage country, a prisoner among degraded blacks. Why was it so difficult to remember that she was only a hated German and a spy? Why would the fact that she was a woman and white always obtrude itself upon his consciousness? He hated her as he hated all her kind, and the fate that was sure to be hers was no more terrible than she in common with all her people deserved. The matter was settled, and Tarzan composed himself to think of other things, yet the picture would not die. It rose in all its details and annoyed him. He began to wonder what they were doing to her, and where they were taking her. He was very much ashamed of himself, as he had been after the episode in Wolhelmstal, when his weakness had permitted him to spare this spy's life. Was he to be thus weak again? No. Night came and he settled himself in an ample tree to rest until morning, but sleep would not come. Instead came the vision of a white girl being beaten by black women, and again of the same girl at the mercy of the warrior somewhere in that dark and forbidding jungle. With a growl of anger and self-contempt, Tarzan arose, shook himself, and swung from his tree to that adjoining, and thus, through the lower terraces, he followed the trail that the Asanga's party had taken earlier in the afternoon. He had little difficulty as the band had followed a well-beaten path, and when toward midnight the stench of a native village assailed his delicate nostrils, he guessed that his goal was near and that presently he should find her whom he sought. Prowling stealthily as prowls Numa, the lion, stalking a wary prey, Tarzan moved noiselessly about the palisade, listening and sniffing. At the rear of the village he discovered a tree whose branches extended over the top of the palisade, and a moment later he had dropped quietly into the village. From hut to hut he went searching with keen ears and nostrils, some confirming evidence of the presence of the girl, and at last, faint and almost obliterated by the odor of the gamangani, he found it hanging like a delicate vapor about a small hut. The village was quiet now, for the last of the beer and the food had been disposed of, and the blacks lay in their huts overcome by stupor, yet Tarzan made no noise that even a sober man keenly alert might have heard. He passed around to the entrance of the hut and listened. From within came no sound, not even the low breathing of one awake. Yet he was sure that the girl had been here and perhaps was even now, and so he entered, slipping in as silently as a disembodied spirit. For a moment he stood motionless just within the entranceway, listening. No, there was no one here, of that he was sure, but he would investigate. As his eyes became accustomed to the greater darkness within the hut, an object began to take form that presently outlined itself in a human form supine upon the floor. Tarzan stepped closer and leaned over to examine it. It was the dead body of a naked warrior from whose chest protruded a short spear. Then he searched carefully every square foot of the remaining floor space, and at last returned to the body again, where he stooped and smelled of the haft of the weapon that had slain the black. A slow smile touched his lips, that and a slight movement of his head betokened that he understood. A rapid search of the balance of the village assured him that the girl had escaped, and a feeling of relief came over him that no harm had befallen her. That her life was equally in jeopardy in the savage jungle to which she must have flown did not impress him as it would have you or me, since to Tarzan the jungle was not a dangerous place. He considered one safer there than in Paris or London by night. He had entered the trees again, and was outside the palisade, when there came faintly to his ears from far beyond the village an old, familiar sound. Balancing lightly upon a swaying branch he stood, a graceful statue of a forest god, listening intently. For a minute he stood thus, and then there broke from his lips the long, weird cry of ape calling to ape, and he was away through the jungle toward the sound of the booming drum of the anthropoids, leaving behind him an awakened and terrified village of cringing blacks, who would forever after connect that eerie cry with the disappearance of their white prisoner and the death of their fellow warrior. Bertha Kircher, hurrying through the jungle along a well-beaten game trail, thought only of putting as much distance as possible between herself and the village before daylight could permit pursuit of her. Whither she was going she did not know, nor was it a matter of great moment since death must be her lot sooner or later. Fortune favored her that night, for she passed unscathed through a savage and lion-ridden an area as there is in all Africa a natural hunting ground which the white man has not yet discovered, where deer and antelope and zebra, giraffe and elephant, buffalo, rhinoceros, and the other herbivorous animals of Central Africa abound unmolested by none but their natural enemies, the great cats which, lured here by easy prey and immunity from the rifles of big game hunters, swarm the district. As he had fled for an hour or two, perhaps, when her attention was arrested by the sound of animals moving about, muttering and growling close ahead. Assured that as he had covered a sufficient distance to ensure her a good start in the morning before the blacks could take to her trail, and fearful of what the creatures might be, she climbed into a large tree with the intention of spending the balance of the night there. As he had no sooner reached a safe and comfortable branch when she discovered that the tree stood upon the edge of a small clearing that had been hidden from her by the heavy undergrowth upon the ground below, and simultaneously she discovered the identity of the beasts as he had heard. In the center of the clearing below her, clearly visible in the bright moonlight, she saw fully 20 huge, man-like apes, great shaggy fellows who went upon their hind feet with only slight assistance from the knuckles of their hands. The moonlight glanced from their glossy coats, the numerous gray-tipped hairs imparting a sheen that made the hideous creatures almost magnificent in their appearance. The girl had watched them but a minute or two when the little band was joined by others, coming singly and in groups until there were fully 50 of the great brutes gathered there in the moonlight. Among them were young apes and several little ones clinging tightly to their mother's shaggy shoulders. Presently the group parted to form a circle about what appeared to be a small, flat-topped mound of earth in the center of the clearing. Squatting close about this mound were three old females armed with short, heavy clubs with which they presently began to pound upon the flat top of the earth mound which gave forth a dull, booming sound, and almost immediately the other apes commenced to move about restlessly, weaving in and out aimlessly until they carried the impression of a moving mass of great, black maggots. The beating of the drum was in a slow, ponderous cadence, at first without time, but presently settling into a heavy rhythm to which the apes kept time with measured tread and swaying bodies. Slowly the mass separated into two rings, the outer of which was composed of chess and the very young, the inner of mature bulls. The former ceased to move, and squatted upon their haunches, while the bulls now moved slowly about in a circle the center of which was the drum and all now in the same direction. It was then that there came faintly to the ears of the girl from the direction of the village as he had recently quitted a weird and high-pitched cry. The effect upon the apes was electrical. They stopped their movements and stood in attitudes of intent listening for a moment, and then one fellow, huger than his companions, raised his face to the heavens and in a voice that sent the cold shudders through the girl's slight frame answered the far-off cry. Once again the beaters took up their drumming, and the slow dance went on. There was a certain fascination in the savage ceremony that held the girl spellbound, and as there seemed little likelihood of her being discovered, she felt that she might as well remain the balance of the night in her tree, and resume her flight by the comparatively greater safety of daylight. Assuring herself that her packet of papers was safe, she sought as comfortable a position as possible among the branches, and settled herself to watch the weird proceedings in the clearing below her. A half hour passed, during which the cadence of the drum increased gradually. Now the great bull, that had replied to the distant call, leaped from the inner circle, to dance alone between the drummers and the other bulls. He leaped and crouched and leaped again, now growling and barking, again stopping to raise his hideous face to Goro, the moon, and, beating upon his shaggy breast, uttered a piercing scream, the challenge of the bull ape, had the girl but known it. He stood thus in the full glare of the great moon, motionless after screaming forth his weird challenge. In the setting of the primeval jungle, and the circling apes a picture of primitive savagery and power, a mightily muscled Hercules out of the dawn of life, when from close behind her the girl heard an answering scream, and an instant later saw an almost naked white man drop from a nearby tree into the clearing. Instantly the apes became a roaring, snarling pack of angry beasts. Bertha Kircher held her breath. What maniac was this who dared approach these frightful creatures in their own haunts, alone against 50? She saw the brown-skinned figure bathed in moonlight walk straight toward the snarling pack. She saw the symmetry and the beauty of that perfect body, its grace, its strength, its wondrous proportioning, and then she recognized him. It was the same creature whom he had seen carry Major Schneider from General Kraut's headquarters, the same who had rescued her from Numa, the lion, the same whom he had struck down with the butt of her pistol and escaped, when he would have returned her to her enemies, the same who had slain Hauptmann Fritz Schneider, and spared her life, that night in Wilhelmstal. Fear-filled and fascinated she watched him as he neared the apes. She heard sounds issue from his throat, sounds identical with those uttered by the apes, and though she could scarce believe the testimony of her own ears, she knew that this godlike creature was conversing with the brutes, in their own tongue. Tarzan halted just before he reached the chess of the outer circle. "I am Tarzan of the apes," he cried. "You do not know me, because I am of another tribe, but Tarzan comes in peace, or he comes to fight, which shall it be? Tarzan will talk with your king," and so saying he pushed straight forward through the chess, and the young who now gave way before him, making a narrow lane through which he passed toward the inner circle. Chess and Bayless growled and bristled as he passed closer, but none hindered him, and thus he came to the inner circle of bulls. Here bared fangs menaced him, and growling faces hideously contorted. "I am Tarzan," he repeated. "T. Tarzan comes to dance the dum-dum with his brothers. Where is your king?" Again he pressed forward, and the girl in the tree clapped her palms to her cheeks as she watched, wide-eyed, this madman going to a frightful death. In another instant they would be upon him, rending and tearing until that perfect form had been ripped to shreds. But again the ring parted, and though the apes roared and menaced him, they did not attack, and at last he stood in the inner circle close to the drum, and faced the great king ape. Again he spoke. I am Tarzan of the apes," he cried. "Tarzan comes to live with his brothers. He will come in peace and live in peace, or he will kill, but he has come, and he will stay. Which shall Tarzan dance the dum-dum in peace with his brothers, or shall Tarzan kill first?" "I am Golat, king of the apes," screamed the great bull. "Kill! I kill! I kill!" And with a sullen roar he charged the Tarmangani. The ape man, as the girl watched him, seemed entirely unprepared for the charge, and she looked to see him borne down, and slain at the first rush. The great bull was almost upon him with huge hands outstretched to seize him before Tarzan made a move, but when he did move his quickness would have put Ara, the lightning, to shame. As darts forward the head of Hista, the snake, so darted forward the left hand of the man-beast as he seized the left wrist of his antagonist. A quick turn and the bull's right arm was locked beneath the right arm of his foe in a jujutsu hold that Tarzan had learned among civilized men, a hold with which he might easily break the great bones, a hold that left the ape helpless. "I am Tarzan of the apes," screamed the ape man. "Shall Tarzan dance in peace, or shall Tarzan kill? Apostrophe I kill. I kill. I kill," shrieked Golat. With the quickness of a cat, Tarzan swung the king ape over one hip, and sent him sprawling to the ground. I am Tarzan, king of all the apes," he shouted. "Shall it be peace?" Golat, infuriated, leaped to his feet and charged again, shouting his war cry, "Colon, I kill! I kill! I kill!" And again Tarzan met him with a sudden hold, that the stupid bull, being ignorant of, could not possibly avert a hold and a throw, that brought a scream of delight from the interested audience, and suddenly filled the girl with doubts, as to the man's madness. Evidently he was quite safe among the apes, for she saw him swing Golat to his back, and then catapult him over his shoulder. The king ape fell upon his head and lay very still. "I am Tarzan of the Apes," cried the ape man. "I come to dance the dum-dum with my brothers," and he made a motion to the drummers, who immediately took up the cadence of the dance, where they had dropped it to watch their king slay the foolish Tarmangani. It was then that Golat raised his head and slowly crawled to his feet. Tarzan approached him. "I am Tarzan of the Apes," he cried. "Shall Tarzan dance the dum-dum with his brothers now, or shall he kill first?" Golat raised his bloodshot eyes to the face of the Tarmangani. "Kagoda," he cried, "Tarzan of the Apes will dance the dum-dum with his brothers, and Golat will dance with him." And then the girl in the tree saw the savage man leaping, bending, and stamping with the savage apes in the ancient rite of the dum-dum. His roars and growls were more beastly than the beasts. His handsome face was distorted with savage ferocity. He beat upon his great breast and screamed forth his challenge as his smooth, brown hide brushed the shaggy coats of his fellows. It was weird. It was wonderful. And in its primitive savagery it was not without beauty the strange scene she looked upon, such a scene as no other human being, probably, ever had witnessed, and yet, withal, it was horrible. As she gazed, spellbound, a stealthy movement in the tree behind her caused her to turn her head, and there, back of her, blazing in the reflected moonlight, shone two great, yellow-green eyes. Sheeta, the panther, had found her out. The beast was so close that it might have reached out and touched her with a great, taloned paw. There was no time to think, no time to weigh chances, or to choose alternatives. Terror-inspired impulse was her guide as, with a loud scream, she leaped from the tree into the clearing. Instantly the apes, now maddened by the effects of the dancing and the moonlight, turned to note the cause of the interruption. They saw this Tarmangani, helpless and alone, and they started for her. Sheeta, the panther, knowing that not even Numa, the lion, unless maddened by starvation, dares meddle with the great apes at their dum-dum, had silently vanished into the night, seeking his supper elsewhere. Tarzan, turning with the other apes toward the cause of the interruption, saw the girl, recognized her and also her peril. Here again might she die at the hands of others. But why consider it? He knew that he could not permit it, and though the acknowledgement shamed him, it had to be admitted. The leading chefs were almost upon the girl when Tarzan leaped among them, and with heavy blows, scattered them to right and left. And then as the bulls came to share in the kill they thought this new ape thing was about to make, that he might steal all the flesh for himself, they found him facing them with an arm thrown about the creature, as though to protect her. "This is Tarzan's she," he said. "Do not harm her." It was the only way he could make them understand that they must not slay her. He was glad that she could not interpret the words. It was humiliating enough to make such a statement to wild apes about this hated enemy. So once again Tarzan of the Apes was forced to protect a Hun. Growling, he muttered to himself in extenuation. "She is a woman, and I am not a German, so it could not be otherwise." Dropped from the sky, Lieutenant Harold Percy Smith Oldwick, Royal Air Service, was on reconnaissance. A report, or it would be better to say a rumor, had come to the British headquarters in German East Africa that the enemy had landed in force on the west coast and was marching across the Dark Continent to reinforce their colonial troops. In fact, the new army was supposed to be no more than 10 or 12 days' march to the west. Of course, the thing was ridiculous, preposterous, but preposterous things often happen in war, and anyway no good general permits the least rumor of enemy activity to go uninvestigated. Therefore, Lieutenant Harold Percy Smith Oldwick flew low toward the west, searching with keen eyes for signs of a Hun army. Vast forests unrolled beneath him in which a German army corps might have lain concealed, so dense was the overhanging foliage of the great trees. Mountain, meadowland, and desert passed in lovely panorama, but never a sight of man at the young lieutenant. Always hoping that he might discover some sign of their passage, a discarded lorry, a broken limber, or an old campsite, he continued farther and farther into the west until well into the afternoon. Above a tree-dotted plain through the center, of which flowed a winding river, he determined to turn about and start for camp. It would take straight flying at top speed to cover the distance before dark, but as he had ample gasoline and a trustworthy machine, there was no doubt in his mind but that he could accomplish his aim. It was then that his engine stalled. He was too low to do anything but land, and that immediately, while he had the more open country accessible, for directly east of him was a vast forest into which a stalled engine could only have plunged him to certain injury and probable death. And so he came down in the meadowland near the winding river, and there started to tinker with his motor. As he worked, he hummed a tune, some music hall air that had been popular in London the year before, so that one might have thought him working in the security of an English flying field surrounded by innumerable comrades, rather than alone in the heart of an unexplored African wilderness. It was typical of the man that he should be wholly indifferent to his surroundings, although his looks entirely belied any assumption that he was of particularly heroic strain. Lieutenant Harold Percy Smith Oldwick was fair-hatred, blue-eyed, and slender, with a rosy, boyish face that might have been molded more by an environment of luxury, indolence, and ease than the more strenuous exigencies of life's sterner requirements. And not only was the young lieutenant outwardly careless of the immediate future and of his surroundings, but actually so. That the district might be infested by countless enemies seemed not to have occurred to him in the remotest degree. He bent assiduously to the work of correcting the adjustment that had caused his motor to stall without so much as an upward glance at the surrounding country. The forest to the east of him, and the more distant jungle that bordered the winding river, might have harbored an army of bloodthirsty savages, but neither could elicit even a passing show of interest on the part of Lieutenant Smith Oldwick, and even as he looked, it is doubtful if he would have seen the score of figures crouching in the concealment of the undergrowth at the forest's edge. There are those who are reputed to be endowed with that which is sometimes, for want of a better appellation, known as the sixth sense, a species of intuition which apprises them of the presence of an unseen danger. The concentrated gaze of a hidden observer provokes a warning sensation of nervous unrest in such as these, but though 20 pairs of savage eyes were gazing fixedly at Lieutenant Harold Percy Smith Oldwick, the fact aroused no responsive sensation of impending danger in his placid breast. He hummed peacefully, and, his adjustment completed, tried out his motor for a minute or two, then shut it off and descended to the ground with the intention of stretching his legs and taking a smoke, before continuing his return flight to camp. Now for the first time he took note of his surroundings, to be immediately impressed by both the wildness and the beauty of the scene. In some respects the tree-dotted meadowland reminded him of a park-like English forest, and that wild beasts and savage men could ever be a part of so quiet a scene seemed the remotest of contingencies. Some gorgeous blooms upon a flowering shrub at a little distance from his machine caught the attention of his aesthetic eye, and as he puffed upon his cigarette, he walked over to examine the flowers more closely. As he bent above them, he was probably some 100 yards from his plane, and it was at this instant that Numabo, chief of the Wamabo, chose to leap from his ambush and lead his warriors in a sudden rush upon the white man. The young Englishman's first intimation of danger was a chorus of savage yells from the forest behind him. Turning, he saw a score of naked, black warriors advancing rapidly toward him. They moved in a compact mass, and as they approached more closely their rate of speed noticeably diminished. Lieutenant Smith Oldwick realized in a quick glance that the direction of their approach and their proximity had cut off all chances of retreating to his plane, and he also understood that their attitude was entirely warlike and menacing. He saw that they were armed with spears, and with bows and arrows, and he felt quite confident that notwithstanding the fact that he was armed with a pistol, they could overcome him with the first rush. What he did not know about their tactics was that at any show of resistance they would fall back, which is the nature of the native Negroes, but that after numerous advances and retreats, during which they would work themselves into a frenzy of rage by much shrieking, leaping, and dancing, they would eventually come to the point of a determined and final assault. Numabo was in the forefront, a fact which taken in connection with his considerably greater size and more warlike appearance, indicated him as the natural target, and it was at Numabo that the Englishman aimed his first shot. Unfortunately for him, it missed its target, as the killing of the chief might have permanently dispersed the others. The bullet passed Numabo, to lodge in the breast of a warrior behind him, and as the fellow lunged forward with a scream, the others turned and retreated. But to the lieutenant's chagrin, they ran in the direction of the plane instead of back toward the forest, so that he was still cut off from reaching his machine. Presently they stopped and faced him again. They were talking loudly and gesticulating, and after a moment one of them leaped into the air, brandishing his spear and uttering savage war cries, which soon had their effect upon his fellows, so that it was not long ere all of them were taking part in the wild show of savagery, which would bolster their waning courage, and presently spur them on to another attack. The second charge brought them closer to the Englishman, and though he dropped another with his pistol, it was not before two or three spears had been launched at him. He now had five shots remaining, and there were still 18 warriors to be accounted for, so that unless he could frighten them off, it was evident that his fate was sealed. That they must pay the price of one life for every attempt to take his had its effect upon them, and they were longer now in initiating a new rush, and when they did, so it was more skillfully ordered than those that had preceded it, for they scattered into three bands which, partially surrounding him, came simultaneously toward him from different directions, and though he emptied his pistol with good effect, they reached him at last. They seemed to know that his ammunition was exhausted, for they circled close about him now with the evident intention of taking him alive, since they might easily have riddled him with their sharp spears with perfect safety to themselves. For two or three minutes they circled about him until, at a word from Numabo, they closed in simultaneously, and though the slender young lieutenant struck out to right and left, he was soon overwhelmed by superior numbers, and beaten down by the hafts of spears in brawny hands. He was all but unconscious when they finally dragged him to his feet, and after securing his hands behind his back, pushed him roughly along ahead of them toward the jungle. As the guard prodded him along the narrow trail, Lieutenant Smith Oldwick could not but wonder why they had wished to take him alive. He knew that he was too far inland for his uniform to have any significance to this native tribe to whom no inkling of the World War probably ever had come, and he could only assume that he had fallen into the hands of the warriors of some savage potentate upon whose royal caprice his fate would hinge. They had marched for perhaps half an hour, when the Englishman saw ahead of them, in a little clearing upon the bank of the river, the thatched roofs of native huts showing above a crude but strong palisade. And presently he was ushered into a village street, where he was immediately surrounded by a throng of women and children and warriors. Here he was soon the center of an excited mob whose intent seemed to be to dispatch him as quickly as possible. The women were more venomous than the men, striking and scratching him whenever they could reach him, until at last Numabo, the chief, was obliged to interfere to save his prisoner for whatever purpose he was destined. As the warriors pushed the crowd back, opening a space through which the white man was led toward a hut, Lieutenant Smith Oldwick saw coming from the opposite end of the village a number of Negroes wearing odds and ends of German uniforms. He was not a little surprised at this, and his first thought was that he had at last come in contact with some portion of the army which was rumored to be crossing from the west coast, and for signs of which he had been searching. A rueful smile touched his lips as he contemplated the unhappy circumstances which surrounded the accession of this knowledge, for, though he was far from being without hope, he realized that only by the merest chance could he escape these people and regain his machine. Among the partially uniformed blacks was a huge fellow in the tunic of a sergeant, and as this man's eyes fell upon the British officer, a loud cry of exultation broke from his lips, and immediately his followers took up the cry, and pressed forward to bait the prisoner. "Where did you get the Englishman?" asked Isanga, the black sergeant, of the chief Numabo. "Are there many more with him?" He came down from the sky, replied the native chief, and a strange thing which flies like a bird, and which frightened us very much at first. But we watched for a long time and saw that it did not seem to be alive, and when this white man left it, we attacked him, and though he killed some of my warriors, we took him, for we Wamabos are brave men and great warriors. Isanga's eyes went wide. He flew here through the sky? He asked. Yes, said Numabo. I in a great thing which resembled a bird he flew down out of the sky. The thing is still there, where it came down close to the four trees near the second bend in the river. We left it there because, not knowing what it was, we were afraid to touch it, and it is still there, if it has not flown away again. It cannot fly, said Isanga, without this man in it. It is a terrible thing which filled the hearts of our soldiers with terror, for it flew over our camps at night and dropped bombs upon us. It is well that you captured this white man, Numabo, for with his great bird he would have flown over your village tonight, and killed all your people. These Englishmen are very wicked white men. He will fly no more, said Numabo. It is not intended that a man should fly through the air. Only wicked demons do such things as that, and Numabo, the chief, will see that this white man does not do it again, and with the words he pushed the young officer roughly toward a hut in the center of the village, where he was left under guard of two stalwart warriors. For an hour or more the prisoner was left to his own devices, which consisted in vain and unremitting attempts to loosen the strands which fettered his wrists, and then he was interrupted by the appearance of the black sergeant Isanga, who entered his hut and approached him. What are they going to do with me? Asked the Englishman. My country is not at war with these people. You speak their language. Tell them that I am not an enemy, that my people are the friends of the black people, and that they must let me go in peace. Isanga laughed. They do not know an Englishman from a German, he replied. It is nothing to them what you are, except that you are a white man and an enemy. Then why did they take me alive? Asked the lieutenant. Come, said Isanga, and he led the Englishman to the doorway of the hut. Look, he said, and pointed a black forefinger toward the end of the village street, where a wider space between the huts left a sort of plaza. Here Lieutenant Harold Percy Smith Oldwick saw a number of negresses engaged in laying faggots around a stake, and in preparing fires beneath a number of large cooking vessels. The sinister suggestion was only too obvious. Isanga was eyeing the white man closely, but if he expected to be rewarded by any signs of fear, he was doomed to disappointment, and the young lieutenant merely turned toward him with a shrug. Really now, do you beggars intend eating me? Not my people, replied Isanga. We do not eat human flesh, but the Wamabos do. It is they who will eat you, but we will kill you for the feast, Englishman. The Englishman remained standing in the doorway of the hut, an interested spectator of the preparations for the coming orgy that was so horribly to terminate his earthly existence. It can hardly be assumed that he felt no fear. Yet, if he did, he hid it perfectly beneath an imperturbable mask of coolness. Even the brutal Isanga must have been impressed by the bravery of his victim, since, though he had come to abuse, and possibly to torture the helpless prisoner, he now did neither, contenting himself merely with berating whites as a race and Englishmen especially, because of the terror the British aviators had caused Germany's native troops in East Africa. No more, he concluded, will your great bird fly over our people dropping death among them from the skies. Isanga will see to that, and he walked abruptly away toward a group of his own fighting men who were congregated near the stake, where they were laughing and joking with the women. A few minutes later the Englishman saw them pass out of the village gate, and once again his thoughts reverted to various futile plans for escape. Several miles north of the village, on a little rise of ground close to the river where the jungle, halting at the base of a knoll, had left a few acres of grassy land sparsely wooded, a man and a girl were busily engaged in constructing a small boma, in the center of which a thatched hut already had been erected. They worked almost in silence, with only an occasional word of direction or interrogation between them. Except for a loincloth, The man was naked, his smooth skin tanned to a deep brown by the action of sun and wind. He moved with the graceful ease of a jungle cat, and when he lifted heavy weights, the action seemed as effortless as the raising of empty hands. When he was not looking at her, and it was seldom that he did, the girl found her eyes wandering toward him, and at such times there was always a puzzled expression upon her face, as though she found in him an enigma which she could not solve. As a matter of fact, her feelings toward him were not untinged with awe, since in the brief period of their association he had discovered in this handsome godlike giant the attributes of the Superman, and the savage beast closely intermingled. At first he had felt only that unreasoning feminine terror which her unhappy position naturally induced. To be alone in the heart of an unexplored wilderness of Central Africa with a savage wild man was in itself sufficiently appalling, but to feel also that this man was a blood enemy, that he hated her and her kind, and that in addition thereto he owed her a personal grudge for an attack he had made upon him in the past, left no loophole for any hope that he might accord her even the minutest measure of consideration. As he had seen him first months, since when he had entered the headquarters of the German High Command in East Africa, and carried off the luckless Major Schneider, of whose fate no hint had ever reached the German officers. And as he had seen him again upon that occasion, when he had rescued her from the clutches of the lion, and, after explaining to her that he had recognized her in the British camp, had made her prisoner. It was then that he had struck him down with the butt of her pistol and escaped. That he might seek no personal revenge for her act had been evidenced in Wilhelmstal the night that he had killed Hauptmann Fritz Schneider and left without molesting her. No, she could not fathom him. He hated her, and at the same time he had protected her as had been evidenced again, when he had kept the great apes from tearing her to pieces after he had escaped from the Wamabo village to which Isanga, the black sergeant, had brought her a captive. But why was he saving her? For what sinister purpose could this savage enemy be protecting her from the other denizens of his cruel jungle? She tried to put from her mind the probable fate which awaited her, yet it persisted in obtruding itself upon her thoughts, though always she was forced to admit that there was nothing in the demeanor of the man to indicate that her fears were well grounded. She judged him perhaps by the standards other men had taught her, and because she looked upon him as a savage creature, she felt that she could not expect more of chivalry from him than was to be found in the breasts of the civilized men of her acquaintance. Fräulein Bertha Kircher was by nature a companionable and cheerful character. She was not given to morbid forebodings, and above all things she craved the society of her kind, and that interchange of thought which is one of the marked distinctions between man and the lower animals. Tarzan, on the other hand, was sufficient unto himself. Long years of semi-solitude among creatures whose powers of oral expression are extremely limited had thrown him almost entirely upon his own resources for entertainment. His active mind was never idle, but because his jungle mates could neither follow nor grasp the vivid train of imaginings that his man mind wrought, he had long since learned to keep them to himself, and so now he found no need for confiding them in others. This fact, linked with that of his dislike for the girl, was sufficient to seal his lips for other than necessary conversation, and so they worked on together in comparative silence. Bertha Kircher, however, was nothing if not feminine, and she soon found that having someone to talk to who would not talk was extremely irksome. Her fear of the man was gradually departing, and she was full of a thousand unsatisfied curiosities as to his plans for the future in so far as they related to her, as well as more personal questions regarding himself, since she could not but wonder as to his antecedents, and his strange and solitary life in the jungle, as well as his friendly intercourse with the savage apes among which he had found him. With the waning of her fears she became sufficiently emboldened to question him, and so she asked him what he intended doing after the hut and boma were completed. "I am going to the west coast where I was born," replied Tarzan. "I do not know when. I have all my life before me, and in the jungle there is no reason for haste. We are not forever running as fast as we can from one place to another, as are you of the outer world. When I have been here long enough, I will go on toward the west, but first I must see that you have a safe place in which to sleep, and that you have learned how to provide yourself with necessaries. That will take time. You are going to leave me here alone? Cried the girl. Her tones marked the fear which the prospect induced. Why, you are going to leave me here alone in this terrible jungle, a prey to wild beasts and savage men, hundreds of miles from a white settlement, and in a country which gives every evidence of never having been touched by the foot of civilized man? Why not? Asked Tarzan. I did not bring you here. Would one of your men accord any better treatment to an enemy woman? Yes, she exclaimed. They certainly would. No man of my race would leave a defenseless white woman alone in this horrible place. Tarzan shrugged his broad shoulders. The conversation seemed profitless, and it was further distasteful to him for the reason that it was carried on in German, a tongue which he detested as much as he did the people who spoke it. He wished that the girl spoke English, and then it occurred to him that as he had seen her in disguise in the British camp carrying on her nefarious work as a German spy, she probably did speak English, and so he asked her. Of course I speak English, she exclaimed, but I did not know that you did. Tarzan looked his wonderment, but made no comment. He only wondered why the girl should have any doubts as to the ability of an Englishman to speak English, and then suddenly it occurred to him that she probably looked upon him merely as a beast of the jungle who by accident had learned to speak German through frequenting the district which Germany had colonized. It was there only that as he had seen him, and so she might not know that he was an Englishman by birth, and that he had had a home in British East Africa. It was as well, he thought, that she knew little of him, as the less she knew the more he might learn from her, as to her activities in behalf of the Germans, and of the German spy system, of which she was a representative, and so it occurred to him to let her continue to think that he was only what he appeared to be, a savage denizen of his savage jungle, a man of no race and no country, hating all white men impartially, and this in truth was what she did think of him. It explained perfectly his attacks upon Major Schneider and the Major's brother, Hauptmann Fritz. Again they worked on in silence upon the boma, which was now nearly completed, the girl helping the man to the best of her small ability. Tarzan could not but note with grudging approval the spirit of helpfulness she manifested in the oft-times painful labor of gathering and arranging the thorn bushes which constituted the temporary protection against roaming carnivores. Her hands and arms gave bloody token of the sharpness of the numerous points that had lacerated her soft flesh, and even though she were an enemy, Tarzan could not but feel compunction that he had permitted her to do this work, and at last he bade her stop. Why, she asked. It is no more painful to me than it must be to you, and, as it is solely for my protection that you are building this boma, there is no reason why I should not do my share. You are a woman, replied Tarzan. This is not a woman's work. If you wish to do something, take those gourds I brought this morning and fill them with water at the river. You may need it while I am away. While you are away, she said. Why, you are going away? When the boma is built, I am going out after meat, he replied. Tomorrow I will go again and take you and show you how you may make your own kills after I am gone. Without a word she took the gourds and walked toward the river. As she filled them, her mind was occupied with painful forebodings of the future. She knew that Tarzan had passed a death sentence upon her, and that the moment that he left her, her doom was sealed, for it could be but a question of time, a very short time, before the grim jungle would claim her, for how could a lone woman hope successfully to combat the savage forces of destruction which constituted so large a part of existence in the jungle? So occupied was she with the gloomy prophecies that as he had neither ears nor eyes for what went on about her. Mechanically she filled the gourds, and, taking them up, turned slowly to retrace her steps to the boma, only to voice immediately a half-stifled scream, and shrank back from the menacing figure looming before her, and blocking her way to the hut. Golat, the king ape, hunting a little apart from his tribe, had seen the woman go to the river for water, and it was he who confronted her when she turned back with her filled gourds. Golat was not a pretty creature, when judged by standards of civilized humanity, though the chiefs of his tribe, and even Golat himself, considered his glossy black coat shot with silver, his huge arms dangling to his knees, his bullet head sunk between his mighty shoulders, marks of great personal beauty. His wicked, bloodshot eyes and broad nose, his ample mouth and great fighting fangs only enhanced the claim of this Adonis of the forest upon the affections of his chess. Doubtless in the little, savage brain there was a well-formed conviction that this strange belonging to the Tarmangani must look with admiration upon so handsome a creature as Golat, for there could be no doubt in the mind of any that his beauty entirely eclipsed such as the hairless white ape might lay claim to. But Bertha Kircher saw only a hideous beast, a fierce and terrible caricature of man. Could Golat have known what passed through her mind, he must have been terribly chagrined, though the chances are that he would have attributed it to a lack of discernment on her part. Tarzan heard the girl's cry and looking up saw at a glance the cause of her terror. Leaping lightly over the boma, he ran swiftly toward her as Golat lumbered closer to the girl the while he voiced his emotions in low gutturals which, while in reality the most amicable of advances, sounded to the girl like the growling of an enraged beast. As Tarzan drew nearer he called aloud to the ape, and the girl heard from the human lips the same sounds that had fallen from those of the anthropoid. "I will not harm your she," Golat called to Tarzan. "I know it," replied the ape man, "but she does not. She is like Numa and Cheetah, who do not understand our talk. She thinks you come to harm her." By this time Tarzan was beside the girl. "She will not harm you," he said to her. "Why you need not be afraid. This ape has learned his lesson. He has learned that Tarzan is lord of the jungle. He will not harm that which is Tarzan's." The girl cast a quick glance at the man's face. It was evident to her that the words he had spoken meant nothing to him, and that the assumed proprietorship over her was, like the boma, only another means for her protection. "But I am afraid of him," she said. "You must not show your fear. You will be often surrounded by these apes. At such times you will be safest. Before I leave you, I will give you the means of protecting yourself against them should one of them chance to turn upon you. If I were you, I would seek their society. Few are the animals of the jungle that dare attack the great apes when there are several of them together. If you let them know that you are afraid of them, they will take advantage of it, and your life will be constantly menaced. The chiefs especially would attack you. I will let them know that you have the means of protecting yourself and of killing them. If necessary, I will show you how, and then they will respect and fear you." "I will try," said the girl, "but I am afraid that it will be difficult. He is the most frightful creature I ever have seen." Tarzan smiled. "Doubtless he thinks the same of you," he said. By this time other apes had entered the clearing, and they were now the center of a considerable group, among which were several bulls, some young chiefs, and some older ones with their little balas clinging to their backs or frolicking around at their feet. Though they had seen the girl the night of the Dum Dum, when Cheetah had forced her to leap from her concealment into the arena, where the apes were dancing, they still evinced a great curiosity regarding her. Some of the chiefs came very close, and plucked at her garments, commenting upon them to one another in their strange tongue. The girl, by the exercise of all the willpower she could command, succeeded in passing through the ordeal without evincing any of the terror and revulsion that she felt. Tarzan watched her closely, a half-smile upon his face. He was not so far removed from recent contact with civilized people that he could not realize the torture that she was undergoing, but he felt no pity for this woman of a cruel enemy who doubtless deserved the worst suffering that could be meted to her. Yet, notwithstanding his sentiments toward her, he was forced to admire her fine display of courage. Suddenly he turned to the apes. "Tarzan goes to hunt for himself and his she," he said. "Tita she will remain there," and he pointed toward the hut. "See that no member of the tribe harms her. Do you understand?" The apes nodded. W, we will not harm her, said Golat. No, said Tarzan. Why you will not? For if you do, Tarzan will kill you. And then turning to the girl, come, he said, come, I am going to hunt now. You had better remain at the hut. The apes have promised not to harm you. I will leave my spear with you. It will be the best weapon you could have in case you should need to protect yourself, but I doubt if you will be in any danger for the short time that I am away. He walked with her as far as the boma, and when as he had entered he closed the gap with thorn bushes and turned away toward the forest. She watched him moving across the clearing, noting the easy cat-like tread and the grace of every movement that harmonized so well with the symmetry and perfection of his figure. At the forest's edge she saw him swing lightly into a tree and disappear from view, and then, being a woman, she entered the hut and, throwing herself upon the ground, burst into tears. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.